Julien Dutton is a lecturer at King's College London, and he's presently directing a research program there about knowledge, rationality, and choice. And he's going to present a talk entitled, Wondering Whether It Is Rational or Not to Be Certain.
Well, that used to be the title.
It's not the title. Well,
yeah. The abstract is correct, but the title is What to Believe, the View from Knowledge-Oriented Epistemic Consequentialism. I will explain a bit the change. So this is based on joint work that I'm preparing with Brendan Fiederson from Northeastern. So my topic is what to believe. So the epistemologists call that norms of beliefs. A norm of belief is something that selects some belief states. So for instance, you might say, okay, believing P when you don't know P, that's bad. That's not an okay belief state. So that's an example of a norm of belief. You must do the following. Believe P if and only if you know P. So some norms might select belief state by saying, oh, these are the permitted ones and these are the non-permitted ones. Other norms might say, might give a ranking, which you might think of as relative permissibility. There is a bunch of very difficult issues about norms in general, epistemic norms in particular. Okay, so norm for belief selects states, for instance, states which are permitted, which are forbidden. It might rank states. And then there are also these difficult issues. One thing is that norms may differ on sources of the selection. So maybe morality requires you to do something, but the welfare of your family requires you to do something else. There is a slightly different topic of flavors. So the different sources might be compatible with the fact that, morality makes it the case that you ought to do something, and the welfare makes you the case that you ought to do something in the same sense of ought. But it could also be that there are different senses of ought. So there, what you ought to do morally and what you do ought to do aesthetically. And then there are types. It might be that even if you focus on a particular source and a particular flavor, it might be the difference between what objectively ought to be the case versus what's rational and or what's pro tanto, like prima facie required versus what's all things considered required. So when we discuss epistemic norm, epistemologists are very often unspecific about these things. I notice that they make some assumptions about some of these things without stating the assumption explicitly. I will try to steer as much as I can away from this kind of problem, except for one small thing that I will say. There is a standard thing which is, so it goes considering this kind of cases. Suppose that you know that you run marathons and you know that you never ever do less than 4 hours. Never ever done less than 4 hours. You're not that kind of runner. So you know your average running time is well above 3 hours. But you also know that if you manage to convince yourself that you will run in less than 3 hours, then you will do a much better time in the end. So should you believe that you're going to run in less than 3 hours or not? And here a standard line is to say, well, epistemically speaking, you should not believe it because all the evidence suggests that there's no way you're going to be less than 3 hours. But practically speaking, it would be good for you to believe it. It would foster your success in the race. So maybe there are the epistemic norms for belief and maybe practical norms for belief, or epistemic reasons to believe and practical norms for belief. Now, if there is such a distinction, I want to say that this talk is concerned with the epistemic considerations and the epistemic reasons to believe. So that's what I want to say about the paper. Okay. So here's the setup. There are roughly, very broadly, and using terminology that comes from ethics without taking it very, very literally and seriously, but it's like a loose analogy. There are those epistemologists that tend to be like what I will call deontologists. They state the norms as primitive. You know, you just have the norms. You start up with the norms for belief. So you say stuff like I said, you must believe everything that you know and just what you know. This is the norm. And then there are the people who are epistemic consequentialists. So what they do is that they first set up a notion of the epistemic good. There is something that's epistemically good. And then they derive norms as things that will promote the good. So what you ought to do is what is the best things, like the thing that will promote the good or the thing that you can expect will be good. So they have first the notion of epistemic value, and then they derive norms as requirements to promote value. So like a cliche thing that people say in ethics is that the deontologists are the people who think that there is the right comes before the good, and the consequentialists are those who say the good comes before the right. And so that's a bit the picture here. So we'll see in more detail how the epistemic consequentialism works. But there are roughly these two kinds of approaches that you'll see in the literature. Now, the second thing is that whether you are on the knowledge, on the consequentialist camp or on the deontologist approach, you could state the norms in terms of truth or in terms of knowledge. So you could say something like, you must believe everything that's true, or you must believe only things that are true, or you could say you must believe only things that you know. So in the deontologist views, you could have your conditions in terms of truth or in terms of knowledge. You could be the kind of person that has truth norms, the kind of person that has knowledge norms. And similarly, in epistemic value, you could have the value, the core value, sometimes they call it the fundamental epistemic good, could be truth or it could be knowledge. So you basically end up with a square. Now, what happens in the current literature is that there are basically two camps that are well occupied, very busy. There is, on the one hand, there is the people who use the deontologist way of doing things, and they tend to be, I mean, and they use the knowledge thing. So that's basically me. I normally do that, deontologic, knowledge-oriented. I defend stuff like you must be certain of everything that you know and only of what you know, or you must believe something if and only if you know it. So that's not actually what I defend, but that's in the ballpark of what I've been defending recently. And so you can think people like Williamson and a bunch of people are in that corner. So that's the knowledge-oriented deontologist. And then there is another very populated area, which are the people who use truth and use the consequentialist framework. So in formal epistemology in particular, in the last 10 years, there's been a lot of work where people set up truth as the fundamental value. Sometimes they call it accuracy because they consider degrees of belief, and they say an accurate degree of belief is one where, for instance, you have a high degree of belief in something that's true. And so these truth-oriented people or accuracy-oriented people are consequentialists. So they combine, they do truth is a fundamental epistemic value, and then they give you epistemic norm by running the consequentialist machinery. And so my co-author, Brandon Fiddleston, is a major player in the truth-consequentialist thing. And by discussing, we've decided to meet in that corner. So we think that actually there's an interesting place to consider, which is you run the consequentialist machinery, but you take the fundamental epistemic value to be knowledge. And interesting things follow. So that's what I'm going to do today. That's where we met. We are going to take knowledge as the fundamental epistemic good, and we are going to run the consequentialist machinery and see what epistemic norms follow. That's the game. Okay, so before I start, I think I have two preliminaries. One of the reasons why I don't like epistemic consequentialism is because it faces a problem that I call the first objection. It comes from Roderick Firth. I'm gonna, so I don't, that's a serious problem, and I'm gonna say why I don't think we face that in the way we do epistemic consequentialism, or one way to avoid that. And then I will just say a bit about, in order to run the framework, it helps to dissociate belief and knowledge. So the two preliminaries will help to then run the thing. So first thing, the first objection. So here is a standard problem for epistemic consequentialism. So epistemic consequentialists, they tell you, true belief is good, and what you should do, you should manage your epistemic life in a way that you maximize true belief. That's the picture. Utilitarianism tells you, happiness is good, and you should manage your life that maximizes happiness or tends to maximize happiness. So on the epistemic version, people say, well, look, this approach confuses the epistemic and the practical. So they come up with cases like that. Suppose God appears out of the clouds and tell you, if you believe that dolphins are from outer space, then I will make you omniscient. So you realize that if you form the belief that dolphins come from outer space, then you will get to have a lot of true beliefs or have a lot of knowledge. So isn't the epistemic consequentialist forced to say that you should have this belief? And here I side with the objectors that say, look, you have no epistemic reason, like it's not an epistemically correct belief. You have no reason whatsoever, no evidence that dolphins are made from outer space. The only thing is that forming this belief would promote your epistemic goals, like your goals to have a lot of knowledge, but it's not an epistemically, it's not a rational or epistemically justified belief. Or you could take another case that I like, which is, well, if you think about it, if you form the belief that, if you became certain that there is something of which you are certain, you would be guaranteed that this certainty is true. Like, just become certain that there is something of which you are certain, that will be correct. So isn't it the case that the epistemic consequentialist would have to say that, well, actually, everybody should be certain that they are certain of something? Even though maybe you don't have any evidence whatsoever that you are certain of something, but by forming the belief that, by forming the fully certain belief that you are certain of something, you make sure that this thing is true. But again, I don't think you have epistemic reason to believe that you are certain of something. I don't think it's the case that anybody is irrational because they don't believe that they are certain of something. Okay, so how do we avoid this problem? Well, the way we avoid this problem is like the wrong way of thinking of epistemic consequentialism is to imagine that the believer is considering various belief states that they could form in the next instant, a bit like actions. So that's where I don't want to go the line where belief states are action here. So the wrong way is to think that these belief states that are available for evaluation, there are possible action, and then you will decide on the one that will have the most epistemic value. Rather, we're going to use the consequentialist machinery at the very same instance. So right now, we're considering the evidence the belief the subject has, and we are considering various hypothetical belief states that the subject could be in right now. So it's not a kind of, if I form the belief, what would be the consequences case. So actually, for this reason, the very name consequentialism might be misleading. So I hope you'll see how that worked, but I just want to flag this thing that we are not considering possible belief that I could form at the next instant, but what beliefs I have right now, do they have a certain match between my evidence about whether this belief will have epistemic values or not? Okay, so moving on, second thing. So in the truth picture, in the truth is the epistemic value picture, you basically have something like that. So there is, take a proposition. P, it could be true, it could be false. If you believe it and it's true, good. If you believe it and it's false, bad. If you don't believe it and it's true, well, that's bad too. You miss a true belief. And if you don't believe it and it's not true, that's good. So, that's the value picture of the truth guys. I'm going to have the same picture, a similar picture, but with knowledge instead of truth. So I'm going to say, you believe something and you know it, good. You believe something and you don't know it, bad. You fail to believe something that you know bad, and you fail to believe something that you don't know, good. And the lower corner, lower left corner, might puzzle some people. So in epistemology, we standardly consider that if you know something, you believe it. So this situation where, so what is going on in the left corner? It's like, oh, it's bad if you fail to believe something that you know. And that, you might think that never arises, because if you don't believe it, you don't know it. So it couldn't be the case that you know something and you fail to believe it. So two things. I want to consider this case as possible. We are going to look at this case. So one thing to consider is that we are evaluating various hypothetical belief states relative to your current knowledge. So maybe now I know that it's raining outside, and we are considering the belief state that that lacks the belief that it's raining outside compared to my current knowledge. So that makes sense to say, oh, that's a belief state where something that in fact I know is not believed, so that's bad. And then second thing is that if it helps, you might replace the notion of what you know with what you would be in position to know. That's a notion that's used in the literature. Basically, the thing such that if you believe it, you would be knowing them. Yeah, and then you might also think that we know stuff that we don't believe. I mean, I tend to think that if you see like a computer in front of you, but somehow you think you've been I won't go into case, but I think there are like arguments to say that you can have knowledge without belief. But anyway, we don't need them for here. But we'll consider cases like the possibility of not believing something that you in fact know. Okay, so that's enough setup. I started at 10, yes. Right?
Yes, you started at 10. Yeah.
Okay, good. On time. Yeah. Okay, so let's go and crank out the epistemic consequentialism framework with knowledge-oriented value. In fact, a lot of it is common with the truth approach. So we will only consider belief, not belief. We won't consider degrees of belief. Like in the literature, many people consider degrees of belief. How confident you are you maximally confident or non-maximally confident? Here we just consider, okay, either you believe something or you don't believe it. So a belief state is basically something that specifies for every proposition whether it's believed or not. I use this notation, so B of P is 1 if you believe that P, and B of P is 0 if you don't believe that P. Then we are considering a bunch of so-called possible words, which are possibilities for what is true and what is known. So maybe we'll consider, oh, what happens if P is true and P is known? What happens if P is true and P is not known? You might think of them as either all the possibilities, or sometimes we'll consider them as basically what's possible given a subject's evidence. And we don't have to say yet what a subject's evidence is. Okay, and we can use like truth, like T for truth. So if P is true at word W, then we write T, P, W is 1, and otherwise 0, and the same with knowledge. The only assumption I'm going to use about knowledge is that what's known is true. So if you know something, it's true. I'm not going to assume any closure under internal. Okay. So now, there is a little complication straight for the start. There are two ways to value. There are more than two ways, but the two fairly straightforward ways to value, to assign value to belief and not belief. So one I call symmetric value. So it works, you have that whether either you use truth or knowledge. So let's consider truth. So on the first, on this symmetric picture, what I call the symmetric picture, the idea is that if P is true, the accurate or correct state is believing that P. If P is false, the accurate state is not believing that P. So we have accurate state is good, 1, and inaccurate state, so believing something that's false or failing to believe something that's true, that's 0. So that's one way of doing this. So similarly, you replace truth with knowledge, you get believing what you know is 1, it's good. Failing to believe something that you don't know, that's 1, that's equally good. And then 0, here meaning bad, for belief in something that you don't know or no belief in something that you know. So that's a fairly simple proposal. So there is accurate gets value 1, inaccurate gets value 0. There is another way of thinking of values of belief. The other way of thinking says, if you don't believe P, then you know that's kind of the baseline. You don't believe P, baseline, we could say 0. Then if you believe P, two things might happen. If you have a belief in something true, that's good. That's a piece of correctness. If you have a belief in something false, that's bad. That's lower than 0. That's an error. And then you might think that it might be that making errors is worse, like the way it is, like the difference, how do you say that? You said it very well in your talk, like the cost of the... Yeah, exactly. So basically the goodness of true belief is less than the wrongness of false belief. That's the idea. So you have the rightness or the goodness of getting it right and the wrongness of getting it wrong, and the wrongness of getting it wrong is bigger than the goodness of being right. Actually, I made a mistake here. I want to say that W is greater or equal to R. So the you can consider that the goodness of being correct is as much as the wrongness of being incorrect, or the wrongness of being incorrect might be worse than the goodness of being correct. So do you think that avoiding error is more important than getting at the truth, or you think they are equally important? So there are these two ways of thinking. In the first way of thinking, there is this accuracy system. In the other way of thinking, no belief gets you baseline, and then belief gets you better or worse depending on whether you get it right or wrong, with this possible asymmetry between rightness and wrongness. Okay, you have the same thing for degrees. But so you have this duality. Fortunately, we can get rid of the duality and see that the two standards or the two ways of thinking fall in the same. So basically, the message of this slide is that if you have the rightness of getting it right and the wrongness of getting it wrong are equal, then that's the special case that's equivalent to having the simple way of valuing. So in fact, we can do everything in the rightness-wrongness framework, and in the special case where the rightness and the wrongness are the same, then the two beliefs are equal. So how does it go? Well, basically, consider. So let's assume. Let's put ourselves in a frame of mind where the rightness of being wrong and the wrongness of being wrong are of the same value. Now take two belief functions and suppose they disagree on P. So that means one believes P and the other one does not believe P, like just suspends, or the first suspends on P and the second one believes P. And suppose, you know, one of them is right, let's say B is right. So basically, if you run the calculation, you will find that on the simple way of valuing, then the value that the belief, that the first one, the right one gets, is plus one of what the wrong one gets. And in the more sophisticated way of valuing with rightness and wrongness, you will find that if it's that basically the difference between the two is either R or W, but we're assuming that R and W are the same, so the difference is plus R. So basically the relative size, the relative ranking of belief state at a word will be the same whether you use the sophisticated or the simple. And so as long as we consider norms that tolerate a certain transformation at every word, there is no difference in using the sophisticated with W equals R or using the simple. Okay, so this is how we calculate the value of a belief state at a word. We just make the sum of the value for each particular beliefs. But in fact, in the results we use here, the average would work just as well. And then the expected value is calculated in a standard way, but the interesting thing to notice is that the expected value relative to a certain probability of a belief state is the sum of the expected value for each proposition. That means that you can consider each proposition isolately, in isolation, to get the final expected value. There is no like holistic effect like, oh, I'm losing a bit of truth here, but I'm getting a bit of truth over there. Okay. So what makes the difference between valuing in terms of truth and valuing in terms of knowledge? Well, with the valuing in terms of truth, if you consider a belief P and not P, it has to be that at most one of them is right. At most one of the belief is right. And at least one of them is right. With knowledge, at most one of them is right, but possibly both of them are wrong. So it might be that you don't know P and you don't know not P. So that's one difference. And another difference is that is the relation between beliefs about P and beliefs about not knowing P. And we'll see how that shows up in certain results. So I'm going to put three norms in terms of epistemic value. So one is non-dominance. So you're irrational if your belief state is such that there is another belief state that's guaranteed to do at least as good, possibly better. That's called dominance. So here's a possible here's an application. Is it irrational to believe a contradiction? So believe both P and not P. If you consider the true valuation, you compare believing P and believing not P with the state that believes P and suspends on not P and the state that suspends on both. Basically, what you find is that if the rightness of being right is equal to the wrongness of being wrong, believing both P and not P gets a total value of zero, which is the same as suspending on both. And you can't really rule out, I mean, you should be indifferent between believing both P and not P or being indifferent on both. So there is no, like, dominance doesn't rule out P, believing both P and not P on the truth view. On the knowledge view, by contrast, you get the thing that if you don't know P and you don't know not P, then you're definitely worse than if you're suspending on P or not P. And so if you run the knowledge evaluation, you realize that believing P and believing not P is systematically is at least as you know, at most as good as suspending on both and possibly worse. So you should never do that. You should, if anything, you should suspend on both. So that's a result you get from the knowledge thing by dominance. Okay, and then two other principles. One is maximizing expected value. So if your belief state is rational, there should be some probability function relative to which you maximize epistemic value, and evidential support. Your belief state should be such that everything you believe is as a relative to some probability function, everything you believe has a threshold higher than 1/2. If we get it, like, we can discuss the second one in talk, but in Q&A, I won't take on it. Okay, now here's the main result. There is a, take a belief state. You say that it's truth represented by a probability function if it's as follows. This belief state believes everything that has a probability higher than a certain threshold according to that probability function. So the belief state and the probability function go together in the sense that everything that's higher than a certain threshold on the probability function is believed. And something is knowledge represented by a probability function if you believe everything, so this belief state believes everything such that the probability of knowing that thing is higher than a certain threshold on the probability function. And the results we get is that if your belief is a sufficiency result, so if your belief satisfies this condition in terms of truth or in terms of knowledge, then it satisfies the true principles, the three principles for truth, or respectively the three principles for knowledge. Okay. But what I want to, how much time do I have?
10 minutes.
Awesome. Yeah, so what I want to focus is the cool outcomes or the interesting outcomes of this view. So first thing, Moore's paradox. So Moore's paradox is beliefs of the form P and I don't know P. And there is a lot of people think these beliefs are irrational. It's kind of irrational to believe P and I don't know P. So the short thing is that if you consider truth on the truth way of valuing, it's possible. So it could be true that that P is true, and also that you don't know P. You know, that's something that could happen, that, you know, maybe it's raining outside and I don't know it. So it could be true that P and I don't know P. And because of that, on the truth way of counting stuff, if the probabilities are right, it will be probable enough for belief. So basically, the truth way of valuing may recommend believing P and I don't know P in some cases, because it's highly probable that P, and also highly probable that you don't know it. So an example would be lottery situation. We'll see that, where you should believe my ticket is going to lose, and I don't know that my ticket is going to lose. So that's a result. Interestingly, on the knowledge valuation, it is always bad to believe P and I don't know P. On the knowledge way of valuating, if you believe P and I don't know P, at most you have one right, one wrong, and then you get zero or worse. Or you are wrong on both, because you neither know P and you neither know that you don't know P. That could happen. So this gets the more paradox, like the knowledge deontology people. So the first result. Second result, lotteries. So a lottery is like, there are many tickets. The only thing you know is that one ticket is going to win by the truth. And then consider the proposition, this ticket is going to lose, this ticket is going to lose, this ticket is going to lose. The standard truth picture says, well, the probability that this ticket is going to lose is high, the probability that this ticket is going to lose is high, and so on and so forth. So if you believe each of these things, you're going to get a lot of truth. And if you also believe that some of them, one of them is going to win, you also get a lot of truth. So the truth way of valuing gets you the result that you should believe of each particular ticket that is going to lose, and you should also believe the claim that some of these is going to win. So it recommends believing that the ticket is going to lose, and it recommends this inconsistent set of beliefs. Now, the knowledge version. The standard view on the lottery is that in the lottery, you don't know that the tickets are going to win. So you are sure that you're not going to get any value from believing that the ticket is going to lose. So because of that, it is you get the result that you shouldn't believe that any single ticket is going to win, but you should believe that some ticket or other is going to win. So sorry, you shouldn't believe that any particular ticket is going to lose. So that's like the knowledge people. Here is a place where it differs from the standard knowledge people. So that's the preface paradox. So the preface paradox goes as follows. An author has carefully researched a book, and they have really paid attention to every claim in the book, and they have researched carefully, but it's a very tedious book. Maybe it's a book like every line in the book is the phone number of somebody from some old phone company. So for every claim, they are like, what is the phone number of this guy? And they look in the phone book from the 70s, California, and they enter the number by typing. So they are very careful at everything. But they also know, because they've done that for the 50 other US states, they also know that there's always a mistake. You know, there's almost always a mistake. It's super hard to write the whole book and not make a mistake. So because they have very carefully researched every claim in the book, but at the same time, they know that books this side, you know, almost always, as far as we know, always have mistakes. So they write in the preface, I have no doubt that there is a mistake in the book. So they seem to be in an contradictory belief state. They believe everything in the book, but they also believe that one of these things at least is false. Now let's run the knowledge thing on that. Well, here is a suggestion. As opposed to the lottery, since here for each claim in the book, it's likely that you know it. You researched it, and if you get things right, you know it. So let's just assume that for each claim in the book, it's likely that you know it. It's also likely that you know the preface, because for the same reason, you research it very well. It is the case that most books make mistakes, and if indeed this is one of the ordinary books, not a special, miraculously error-free book, then you do know that your book came mistake. So it is also very likely, not certain, but very likely that you know the preface. And so basically here the knowledge version says, okay, you should believe every claim in the books and you should also believe the preface claim. So you should have this contradictory set of belief. So the most pressing or striking version of the case involves three claims. So you have a book with two claims, P1, P2, and then you have the preface claim Q that one is false. And so you know that it's almost, you know, you would normally make the mistake on either of them. And the probabilities might be as follows, that either you make a mistake on the first one, in which case you don't know the first one, but you know the second one and you know the preface, or you made a mistake on the second one, in this case you know the first one, you know the preface, but you don't know the second one, or you made no mistake in the main part of the book, so you don't know the preface. And in each of those cases, you get a value that's above zero, so that's better than suspending on everything. So these, unlike knowledge people will say you should believe only what you know, they will have to say that there is some claim in the book that you shouldn't believe, or you shouldn't believe the preface. But there is something that goes wrong somewhere. Well, this view says, no, you should have the contradictory set of belief. You should believe the preface, and you should also believe the content of the book. I should press that this is a very good result, there are very good reasons to like this result, because for instance, I think it's very reasonable for me to think that some of my beliefs are false. It would be crazy for me to think that none of my beliefs are false. It seems to be very rational for me to believe everything that I, you know, maybe I'm totally rational and I believe everything that, and all my beliefs are rational, and it's also very rational for me to believe that some of my beliefs are false. So I think it's a very striking general thing. And also, it would be crazy to think that because it's very rational for me to believe that some of my beliefs are false, I should kind of suspend on my belief or adopt a weaker set of belief. In the book, you might think that, what the author should do is suspend on every particular claim in the book and retreat to some claim like most of the things in the book are true. So I don't believe that, but I believe that that is part of a body of claims, most of which are true. I don't think that's very plausible either. So anyway, I think that's a interesting result. Do you have some more time for more, or should I stop here?
2 minutes.
Okay, so I'll talk about this a bit because that connects to, Giovanni. Giovanni, yes, that connects to Giovanni's talk. Yeah, so so here is, there is this kind of problem in the law that that arise when whether we can condemn people on the basis of so-called bare statistical evidence. So compare these two cases. So in the first cases, this guy Smith gets sued for gate crashing at a concert or a rodeo. Gate crashing means like they entered without paying. They climbed over the fence to get in and attend the show. So they are sued. The people who sue them, they are saying that, well, look, there is this guardians or whoever, I've seen you climbing over the fence. So that's the first case. Like, okay, we sue this guy because somebody has seen them climbing over the fence. Second case, the Smith gets sued for gate crashing at the rodeo. But here, the attacker says just, well, look, there were 1,000 people in the audience. We have only sold 10 tickets. So 90% of the people who were in the audience have not paid, and this guy was in the audience. We've seen him in the audience. So we sue him because he has most likely not paid the price. And that raises a puzzle because some of the legal standards for civil courts are formulated in terms not of beyond reasonable doubt, but in terms of the preponderance of evidence, if it's more likely than not that the thing happened. And here you say, in case B, the lawyers would say, well, it's more likely than not, 90% of chance that this guy sued. But most people would say, well, you should sue judge guilty, you know, make them pay a fine in case A, but not in case B. In case B, it would be unfair to say, oh, you're going to pay a fine because you're a randomly selected person in a group where most people were thieves, you know. And so what do we say about that? The truth people would have to say that, well, at least in both cases, you should believe that the guy has gate crashed. But here is a way of thinking from the knowledge point of view. You think, well, if the witness guy did correctly see the other one and reports faithfully what they saw, then I get to know. And by contrast, by the mere statistical chance, I don't get to know that the person gate crashed. Of course, I'm not sure that the witness is reliable, so it could be that they are mistaken, in which case I don't get to know. But it might be that the chances that I get knowledge from the testifier is 90%. And then the knowledge thing would say, well, if the chance that you get to know is high enough, then you should judge that the person gate crashed. And that would explain why we should judge condemn in A and not in B. And that suggests a version to understand beyond reasonable doubt as well, where beyond reasonable doubt doesn't mean 99% likely. I mean, if there were 1,000 people and all of them except 10 had committed murder, you take a random person, are you going to jail them for murder? No. So what does this beyond reasonable doubt mean? It cannot be 90% likely. So one suggestion, it means 90% likely that we know that the person committed. And then in the case where we take a person at random, it's like a lottery. We don't get knowledge. So we're sure we don't get knowledge. So that's another nice result. So here are some of the nice pattern of result that we get from this view. Thank you.
Thank you very much.